So welcome to the evening Dhamma talk. Tonight I'm going to begin with some poetry, move to some stories, and then come to some text by the Buddha. I'm hoping by the time I get to the very complicated text that you will have understood from the poetry and the stories. Let's see how we go. So the theme tonight is mindfulness and the heart of peace. In the Sutta Nibbata, the Buddha says, "The liberated ones live mindfully and in peace." The liberated ones live mindfully. So this is actually our task. Not to wait until sometime in the distant future we're going to be liberated and then we can live mindfully and in peace. But rather, now, to discover for ourselves the heart of peace and to give expression to that in all that we do in this life. As best we can. We may not do it perfectly, but this is the goal and the aim of the teaching. Firstly, of course, it's to find a way of being with ourselves in peace. And we heard yesterday, with our moving Dhamma talk, our friendship, kindness, love, compassion are the qualities of the heart to be developed in order to have the understanding of peace, or in order to express and show and reveal our understanding. The two go together. In fact, we could say that to understand the Dhamma is to be peace. It's to be peace in this world that's so fraught with conflict. Not only here in the Middle East, but certainly in other parts of the world. There's war, there's conflict, there's cruelty, there's unspeakable horror. So our task is to practice. And through mindfulness, the body, speech, and mind give expression to liberating freedom. That's what's being asked of us as practitioners of the Dhamma. Nothing less will do. In Asia, there's a word that's used to describe this. And many of you will know this already, but it's Nibbana. In Pali, it's Nibbana. In Sanskrit, Nirvana. In Australia, there's a band called Nirvana. Rock band. Anyway, that's a little side trip. I think it was a heavy metal band, actually. It is Nibbana, which means literally coolness. Cool or the absence of heat. That's what Nibbana actually means. In ordinary everyday language in Thailand, the rice actually Nibbana's, cools off. So it refers to the absence of heat or the dukkha, the absence of suffering. When I left Israel last time, I went to Bangkok, I taught there for a couple of days, and then, at least I think it was on my way home, I was in the bookshop in the airport, as one is, waiting for a flight. And suddenly, right in front of me, a book just fell on the floor at my feet. I did not knock that book onto the floor. And so, feeling, I picked up the book, of course, and put it back on the shelf. And then I saw what it was. This little book called The Truth of Nature by Ajahn Buddhadasa. Ajahn Buddhadasa is one of the great teachers of Thailand, one of the great teachers of emptiness. He's one of Christopher's teachers, and also one of my teachers. And in 1976, when I was young, I went to Wat Suan Mok, to Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery, and he welcomed me. And in fact, he invited me to stay there as long as I wished. And so the fact that this book fell at my feet, I thought was a little bit cosmic. So I picked up the book, I put it back, and then a moment later I thought, I think this book is mine. So I scrambled, looked through my purse, and found just enough baht. I think I had 196 baht left in my purse in Thai currency, and this was 195. And I said, okay, it's mine. So, we're going to hear from it tonight. And Ajahn Buddhadasa was quite radical. He was very innovative. He was renowned for being a very provocative, yet scholarly monk. He was not only scholarly, he practiced. So he had a forest monastery. And he had the monks sit outside. There were three big rocks. And he said, this is the Buddha, this is the Dharma, this is the Sangha. So whether it was raining or not, the monks would sit outside in the forest. So he was an exceptional person, an extraordinary person, and much loved in Thailand. And a great wisdom teacher, and he died in 1993, and it's said that literally, right up until the moment that he was dying, he was preparing a Dharma talk. He was writing a Dharma talk. It was 2 days before his birthday, and he was preparing a Dharma talk when he had a stroke and died. So he was a servant. Buddhadasa means servant of the Dharma. He was a servant of the Dharma, literally until his last breath. An extraordinary teaching. And this is what he says. Well, some of what he says on this theme. He said, the Thai ancestors have a saying, Nibbana is in dying before death. Nibbana is in dying before death. He says, you've probably never heard of this saying, but it's very common among rural people. And then there's a little poem. And he says, they say, beauty is to be found in the dead body. When I read the book, it was slightly strange, but beauty is to be found in the dead body. Goodness is to be found in relinquishment. The monk is to be found in earnestness. Nibbana is to be found in dying before death. And he says, Nibbana is in dying to selfhood before the death. The body. The body doesn't have to die, but attachment to the self idea must. This is nirvana. The person who realizes it has obtained supreme bliss, yet continues to live. That's the good news. Okay? So, the death we're talking about is the death of the identification with I, me, and mine. It's the cessation or the ending of the self-view, the self-idea. This is the death that has been referred to. So with our mindfulness, we illuminate life. Mindfulness is, to be mindful is to shine the light of awareness on all the different aspects of this life. So we shine the light on our joys, on our sorrows, on our loneliness, on our anguish, onto the depths of our despair. When we do this, what's revealed is the movement of the sense of I. And we begin to see where the I sticks, the sticky bits in this life. And when we no longer cling or are stuck in those habitual sticky places, there's peace. Our task is to unstick, if you like, the heart and mind. To see where we are stuck and loosen any holding. In essence, the teachings point to liberation through non-clinging. So that becomes the practice, to loosen and loosen and loosen any whisper of attachment until the heart and mind is. And we need to do this over and over and over again. So the dissolution of all fabrications reveals peace. So we construct and put together with the world of thought this notion and idea of self, who we are in the world, how we are, how we'd like to be. There's often a big gap between the two. How we like to be and how we are. This is our stress. This is our distress. These are our unfulfilled desires. And of course, even in the spiritual world, we want to be more awake. We want to be more spiritual. Our sense of self can land on the idea of I am the meditator just as easily as it can land in other areas of life. The poet, Lala, who was a 14th century mystic from Kashmir, sang and danced naked. Nakedness, of course, for sadhus in India, is a sign of the nakedness of mind. When I first saw a naked sadhu, and I have to tell you, the first naked sadhu I saw was not totally naked. He didn't have any clothing on, except that he was wearing a pair of designer sunglasses. And he was riding the very best bicycle I had ever seen in India to that date. There was a totally naked sadhu in Varanasi with sunnies and a really fantastic bike. I looked at him and I thought, I don't understand. I just don't understand. This is a culture where sexuality is so oppressed and repressed, and yet here, in the middle of this bustling town and city, was a totally naked man. I learned, after being in India for a while, that the nakedness symbolized purity of mind. And, of course, renunciation. Renunciation of all the things that's worn. So Lala, the poet, sang and danced naked. And this is what she said. She said, if you want a kingdom and get it, you'll have no peace. If you give it away, still you won't be content. Only a soul free of desire can taste eternity. Be living, yet dead. Then knowing will come to live in you. I'll repeat the last part. Be living, yet dead. Then knowing will come to live in you. So the knowing she's speaking is the profound knowing, the knowing of truth, the knowing of peace. It's also just the simplicity of knowing what our direct experience is. And the seeing just the seeing, heard just the heard, and sensed just the sensed. These are the teachings of the Buddha. And the knowing comes to live in us. When we dissolve the me, the clinging ceases. So the cessation of the self-view is the cessation of the clinging. The two are the same. So when we give up thinking in terms of I, me, and mine, when we really do that, there's the cessation of clinging in all of its various forms and aspects. In 2002 and 2003, I was in East Timor. East Timor is a small island country to the north of Australia. It's only about a 45-minute flight from Darwin. And for many years it was Portuguese Timor. It was half Indonesian and half Portuguese. And of course you can guess what happened. In the 1970s, Indonesia invaded Portuguese Timor and took over the country. However, in 1999, the Timorese people voted for independence. They had a vote. And people walked from all over the country. They walked for days to vote. It was extraordinary. They queued for days to vote. And they voted to be independent. And now it's Timor-Leste. So they did get their wish. However, it was at an extraordinary cost. Because what happened was Indonesian military came. And also, there were, within the country, militias loyal to Indonesia. And about a third of the population were massacred. A third. It was just a complete nightmare. Australia eventually did send troops, much to Indonesia's horror, to protect the Timorese, but it was rather late. Many, many people died. So we're talking about the death of 300,000 people. And so a couple of years later, I was there. And my partner at the time had a brief to set up a mental health program for the whole of the nation. So there we were, in the aftermath of this huge tragedy and this amazing, terrible situation. So one day we were just driving. I didn't actually live there, it was just standing there. And I was passenger in the car. And we looked to the centre of Delhi, the capital. And as we were driving, There was black smoke just billowing from the center of town. And what had happened is the freedom fighters had become so disillusioned with the extraordinary poverty and the lack of change for which they'd fought, that they'd all come into the town, and as a kind of marauding mob, they'd begun to burn anything that had been rebuilt. So they burned the supermarkets, they burned everything that represented wealth, they burned the shops. And then, of course, they began to kill people. So there we were. So we thought what to do, and it was rather eerie because on the street corners there were lots of young men all just standing rather silently, but with weapons, with knives, with sickles. And so I got out of the car and we took off all the government stickers because we didn't want to be identified. And we thought, okay, we'll just go back to where we were staying and hope for the best, which is what we did. However, that day, this group of people, and we're very understandably frustrated people, went from place to place, burning buildings and attacking people. And they came to a hotel in which I stayed a couple of days before. And they wanted to set it on fire. And this young man who worked there was a waiter at the hotel. Was extraordinarily brave. He decided that he would just face the mob of people. So he was a young man, he must have been 17 years old. And he just stood there, apparently. I spoke to him the next day. He faced them when he stood there and he said, "Please stop. Please." He said, "Please stop. If you burn this hotel, I won't be able to work and I won't be able to feed my family. So please, right now, just stop." And they were so amazed by this. They were so amazed by his fearlessness that they did, they stopped. And so for the rest of that day, and even the next couple of days, the killing and the burning and the looting stopped. And so I talked to this young man. I said, "What did you say? What did you do?" And he said, "I just stood there and I spoke the truth. I just stood there and I spoke the truth." So in that moment, he put aside his own safety. In that moment, whether he lived or died was actually unimportant to him, he said. Whether he lived or died was the same. But what was important was that he spoke the truth. So he put aside his own desires. He put aside his personal safety. And for those moments, he stood in the deathless. He stood in that which is known and understood when we no longer cling to anything, not even our own life. The deathless, the Buddha says, that which is unaffected by birth and death, birth, age, and pain and death. The deathless is liberation through non-clinging. So just for these few moments, this young man stepped, if you like, through to a space of complete and utter fearlessness. And it had the most extraordinary effect on many people. And I think that as human beings sometimes we feel perhaps fearful We know that women be killed, but there can be extraordinary courage, extraordinary bravery, and just standing in the truth. When we do this, the self is empty. Empty of self-existence. So the poets of the world speak about it this way. This is Rumi, and it's a rather famous poem, but it's beautiful. He says, die, die, die in this love. If you die in this love, your soul will be renewed. Die, die. Don't fear the death of that which is known. If you die to the temporal, you will become timeless. So truth is timeless. You know from the sitting, as you sit, and you start to be mindful, we see that the mind can go to the past. And when the mind goes to the past, we remember, we analyze, sometimes we regret. When the mind's caught up in the present, or when the mind's resting in the present, we tend to commentate, evaluate, compare, judge. And then when the mind goes to the future, the other field of time, we plan. We worry, we fantasize, we invent, we imagine, we project, and so on. So there's this movement of the mind that goes on through the fields of time, past, present, future. And we're asked in the teachings to recognize and know that which is not bound to any of the fields of time. We can cling to the past, we can cling to the present, and we can cling to some kind of projection into the future. Yet, it is possible, of course, to reflect on the past with a heart and mind of non-clinging, to be present with a heart and mind of non-clinging, and even to think about the future with a heart and mind of non-clinging. This is usually called vision. So, when we give up attaching to the past and allowing our life to be shaped by the past, is when we're free from the past. So, the teaching is one non-clinging to any of the fields of time. And the poet, of course, Rumi, puts it in a much more wonderful way. He says, die, die, cut off those chains that hold you prisoner to the world of attachment. Die, die, die to the deathless, that you will be eternal. Die, die, come out of this cloud. When you leave the cloud, you will be the effulgent moon. This means the moon that shines really brightly, emanating goodness and purity. Die, die, die to the din and noise of mundane concerns. In the silence of love, you will find the spark of life. I think that's rather beautiful. In the silence of love, you will find the spark of life. I want to tell you a story about that. Two years ago in Australia, a a family experienced an extraordinary and enormous tragedy. They were a family from Western Australia, the western part of Australia, and a woman and her husband and three children and her father-in-law had been holidaying in the Netherlands. And the parents decided to stay for a few more days in Holland, and the father was the grandfather, Nick, was accompanying the children home in the plane. Unfortunately, the plane was Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 that was shot down in Ukrainian territory. And all three of the children and the father died. I have to say that I cannot even imagine the extent of the suffering. Just extraordinary to lose your entire family in such a way, so unexpectedly, and all at once. And these two parents wrote a letter. It was a letter it's addressed to all of us, actually. And I think it's one of the most powerful letters I've ever read. So I'm going to read it to you. It goes like this. The title is Message to the Soldiers in the Ukraine, the Politicians, the Media, Our Friends and Family. Our pain is intense and relentless. We live in a hell beyond hell. Our babies are not heroes. We need to live with this act of horror every day and every moment for the rest of our lives. No one deserves what we are going through. Not even the people who shot our whole family out of the sky. A very powerful movement of compassion there. No hate in the world is as strong as the love we have for our children, for Mo, for Evie, for Otis. No hate in the world is as strong as the love we have for Grandad Nick. No hate in the world is as strong as the love we have for each other. This is a revelation that gives us some comfort. It's extraordinary that they would write such a thing, that they would have the capacity to see beyond their grief and loss. And they say, we would ask everyone to remember this, and when you are making any decisions that affect us and other victims of the horror. So for them, love was not replaced by hatred. And this kind of love, this depth of love, is unsurpassable. And the good news is that just recently, they gave birth to a baby girl, and her name is Violet Maid. And this is the message they send to all of us. They say, we will continue to love all four of our children. Violet brings some hope and joy for us. We hope she brings hope and joy for you too. So I think it's a remarkable statement and a remarkable story. And this is the movement of love. This is the movement of the depth of understanding, of love that's untouched by death and loss and grief. So this is what is asked of us, actually. To give up or be prepared to give up everything. And yet to know a love that is a revelation, a love that can sustain us a love that can be somehow fulfilling. Because when a child dies, children die, and friends die, and loved ones die, love doesn't end. Of course it doesn't. It's ceaseless. It's still there. It doesn't go away. And that's why they say so powerfully, you continue to love all four children equally. I have no idea who this family is and their background, but I think the statements in and of themselves are just precious and wonderful. And that such horror is followed by wisdom, love and compassion is brilliant, it's divine. Because, of course, this kind of tragedy is not just happening to them. It's not just doesn't just happen in odd kind of things. It's happening all around us. So we have to really look and say, okay, how do we want to live? How can we live with the heart of peace? And how can we be so committed to the Dharma that our entire life becomes an expression of peace? That our voice is the voice of peace? That our actions support peace, love and compassion? This is the Dharma teaching. And I promised some text from the Buddha. So, this is how he says it. And he, like Leela did 2 days ago, uses the metaphor of the island. And he says, having nothing, clinging to nothing, that is the island. There is no other. That is Nibbana, I tell you. The total ending of aging and death. And then there's another section of the text. The student Papa comes to the Buddha and he says, there are people stuck midstream in the terror and the fear of the rush of the river of being. And death and decay overwhelm them. For their sakes, sir, he says to the Buddha, tell me where to find an island. Tell me where there is solid ground beyond the reach of all this pain. So, this is the teaching. The teaching is that we learn to know and understand for ourselves where there is solid ground beyond the reach of all this pain. It's a beautiful teaching. So here it is. And so the Buddha, in his compassion, says, for the sake of those people stuck in the middle of the river of being, overwhelmed by death and decay, I will tell you where to find solid ground. And then he says this, which I think is one of the most precious statements ever. He says, there is an island which you cannot go beyond. It is a place of no things, a place of non-possession, and with non-attachment. It is the total end of death and decay. And this is why I call it Nibbana, the cooled. There are people who, in mindfulness, have realized this and are completely cooled here and now. So, a place of nothingness or no things means not only do we see the emptiness of the self, but we also see the emptiness of all things. This is a rather hard concept for me to elucidate, and it's something that's really best understood through meditation practice. a just citizen. We see, first of all, that the self is empty, and then we actually see that all things, everywhere, are empty of self-existence as well. So this is one of the great keys to finding peace. And the next part, it is a place of non-possession. So that's very clear, isn't it? We're not a place where we don't possess or acquire or hold or want. A place of non-attachment. The total end of death and decay. Nirvana, the pool. So, once we understand this, once we realize this, once we see this and know it for ourselves, we live with a heart of peace. Our actions are in accordance with peace. And death no longer holds any fear. This is the deathless teaching of the Buddha. So let's just sit for a few moments. May all beings everywhere know the end of all this pain. May all beings everywhere recognize and realize the island we cannot go beyond, the island of non-clinging. And may all beings everywhere be peace, live in peace, and understand the heart of peace. May we so. Thank you, each of you, for your presence, for your practice, and for listening. May there be peace.